This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
We are all paying too little attention to, you know, the human impact of climate change, to the pressures of climate change, and what that does to society and to politics and to communities, not physically, not the disaster threats and things like that, but what it does to the way that we relate to each other.
Many of us on the left see the fight for environmental justice as going hand in hand with other progressive battles, including racial justice and human rights. But evidently, not all environmentalist efforts are rooted in the same values. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak to Abram Lustgarten, a reporter for ProPublica, about his recent piece chronicling an ugly, hidden side to the history of the American environmentalist movement. We learn about John Tanton, a virulent racist and eugenicist who befriended many environmental leaders, find out how he's connected to the perpetrator of the El Paso Walmart mass shooting, Patrick Crucius, and talk about how white supremacy and xenophobia have come to dominate right-wing rhetoric in this country. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Abram Lustgarten. He's a reporter at ProPublica. Abram, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's been almost a decade, I think, since we've spoken, but I wanted to have you on because you wrote an excellent piece recently for ProPublica entitled "The Ghosts of John Tanton: Climate Change and Anti-Immigrant Hate Are Colliding, Foretelling a Volatile Future." A lot of our discussions about the environmental movement have focused on race, and one of the criticisms that we hear is that it's too white of a movement in many ways. John Tanton is really the poster child for that discussion. Who is he, and why don't you explain how you came to discuss him as part of a larger point you're trying to make in this piece?
Yeah. So John Tanton is a man who started most of the organizations that we now know to be hugely influential in steering and characterizing and setting the tone of our debate over immigration in the United States. But he didn't start out that way. He started out as an avid environmentalist. And going back to the 1950s, 1960s, you know, he was both an early conservationist. He lived in Michigan and he started early conservation groups in Michigan. He was an early member of the Sierra Club and headed the Michigan chapter of the Sierra Club. And he, like many environmentalists of the era, was most concerned about this idea that we were overpopulating the planet, that the number of people on the planet was drawing too much on resources and making life unsustainable. And so he set out, a very intelligent individual and a very organized and networked individual to campaign against overpopulation and to do that in every way that he could. But that evolved over the years. And as the U.S. reproductive rate stabilized in the mid-1970s, immigration became the largest form of population growth for the United States. And he turned all of his interest and energy and eventually his organizations towards battling immigration initially as a form of population control.
And this intersection of anti-immigrant philosophy and environmentalism was born into some of these modern activists like Patrick Crucius, the El Paso mass murderer. Explain how he plays a role in your piece.
Yeah, so I was really interested in trying to trace the evolution of ideas. You know, you hear people say things, you hear Patrick Crucius say that immigrants are a weight on the environmental burden that Texas can handle, or that overpopulation from immigrants is displacing people from homes in the United States or using up too much water. And I'm interested in where those ideas came from and how they evolved. And if you read deeply, as I did, into the history and the writings of John Tanton, he was among the first to try to frame immigration issues and environmental issues in this way. And over the decades that have followed, the organizations that he founded or supported founding, so the Federation for American Immigration Reform, Numbers USA, Center for Immigration Studies being the three primary, very influential groups. They have trafficked in these precise messages for a very, very long period of time. They have formalized and made the argument that immigration is leading to the sprawl that we see outside major American cities, that immigration is responsible for the traffic jams, that immigration is responsible for rising CO2 emissions in the United States and thus for the climate impacts that we're experiencing, and that immigration can account for water shortages and things like that. So when I read the manifesto of someone like Patrick Crucius, this terrible crime, right? He went into a Walmart in El Paso, Texas in 2019 and killed 23 people. And he did that to target Hispanics and migrants specifically. And he wrote a manifesto that touched on these exact themes. I recognize that those themes were not his invention and were not something that he had pulled from very recent or modern influences, but in fact, you know, went back quite a bit of time and had been carefully cultivated, starting with John Tanton.
And John Tanton, as you write, didn't come up with these ideas in a vacuum. He was very effective in evangelizing them. But you go back even further to the roots of the American conservation movement with John Muir and other people who were bordering on eugenicists in many ways.
Yeah, or were eugenicists. But, the intersection between environmentalism and, racist hate actually goes very, very far back, has a deep history. It goes back to, the Nazi Party in Germany and the 1920s, even as far back as the late 1800s, 1890s in Germany, with this idea of ecology and deep ecology and preserving this sort of purity of land and environment. And the argument that the earth is becoming overpopulated and that the earth can't sustain that goes back to, Malthusian principles from, Great Britain in the early 1800s. And so these are very old themes, and they have always evoked, deep feeling and resonance among, a certain part of the population. And that part of the population is, on one hand, concerned with environmental preservation, which many people would argue is a very good thing, but partially out of a motivation to preserve this sense of purity, whether that's purity of water, a clean river running out of the mountains, or purity of place, or purity of people, which for many people means, white people, European descent. So you see this sort of racist inflection point in a lot of what we'd consider the classic environmental movement in the United States. And John Muir, was susceptible to this way of thinking. He advocated, for example, for the clearing of Yosemite Valley in California of Native Americans, and described them as, as dirty people. And, John Muir's writings don't portray him as an outright racist individual, but he's operating at a time, just after the genocide of Native Americans across the country. And he's susceptible to this same sort of thinking, about, a certain type of people as a certain type of pollutant. And you see that also in, the formative environmentalists like Madison Grant, conservationist who, was involved in the establishment and founding of the Bronx Zoo in New York and in Glacier National Park, and and other very influential, environmental movements in the Roosevelt era, where Madison Grant was explicitly motivated by eugenicist ideas and in kind of a racial preservationist calling to preserve what he described as as the great race, meaning the white race of European descent.
Afraid through it all, far too happy, yet well aware. Complain about the sprawl, you discover and found nowhere. And now you've gone and busted your tone. Think once you've met.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Abram Lustgarten from ProPublica. So, Abram, we were talking about this piece that you've written on John Tanton. I think what's so troubling to me reading this is that the progressive movement has put its flag in the ground and said that they are the movement of science, and that the climate change denying class are setting us back. And that's fairly clear. But one of the things that's so troubling about this movement that you write about is that it incorporates science, and they don't deny climate change, and they embrace environmentalism in so many ways, but it takes such a dark, troubling turn.
Yeah, you know, that was a surprising outcome of my reporting, this notion that, you know, so many prominent conservatives, and I'm talking about far right, not kind of middle right conservatives, but so many far right conservatives that I spoke with over the course of my reporting did not deny climate change. And, you know, I think many of us think of, you know, climate change as a Democrat issue and absolutely denied by conservatives. And what I found is denied by the corporate class conservatives, but less so by the cultural and fundamentalist, you know, far right conservatives. And that's because, well, it's for a lot of reasons. I mean, these people that are often more rural and more related to the land that they live on, I found in the extremist communities, you know, they're people that were more sympathetic to the kind of racial arguments that I was just describing, this notion of environmental threat being climate change, threatening environmental purity, which has been, you know, an age-old notion. And, you know, the evolution that I think that we're beginning to see is that, you know, the denial of climate change on the right is, you know, is giving way to an acceptance of climate change. And what that means is that, like every other issue, we will have differing opinions on what to do about it. And so what I began to hear on the right was something along the lines of, yeah, this is happening and it's affecting us and it has meaning for us. And we, as you know, as a body politic, you know, on the far right might have different solutions, or different outcomes we'd like to see than you on the left. And we think that, you know, Democrats are doing a lousy job of, you know, addressing the implications of climate change, because some of them, for example, might be enhanced immigration. And what are we going to do about that? And so there is this sort of early sign of a retaking, a reclaiming of environmentalism and a reclaiming, you know, of climate change as an issue among far right extremists that I spoke with.
And how do these extremists take the current Republican talking point, well, the Donald Trump talking point, that sure, climate change might exist, but that just means that these rising sea levels are going to mean more beachfront property?
Yeah, you know, I found real division there, that this is not a monolithic kind of group when we talk about conservatives. You know, I heard real kind of anger and resentment towards what I described as sort of corporate class Republicans, you know, the idea being, when they think about immigration, that, you know, that there's a corporate class that's pro-immigration because they want cheap labor for, you know, for their big businesses, and they want to undermine the American worker. And on the far right, I heard a little bit more about the need to preserve old historic notions of, you know, American demography, American family, the sanctity of, you know, of our nature and wild places, and, you know, and the sanctity of a majority of European descent racially. So that's a real difference. I don't think that we, you know, I will never again think of, you know, of conservatives or as Republicans as representing, you know, a single view on climate change.
Maybe you can expand on how the rural population has embraced environmentalism in a different way and how that ends up getting distilled into this anti-immigrant sentiment.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many things here, and some of, you know, the conversation about the environmental movement in the United States, you know, is outside the scope of this reporting, except to say that, you know, there's long been, you know, some interesting overlaps between the goals of, you know, what we'd call standard environmentalists, mainstream environmentalism in the United States, and, you know, and if not explicitly, you know, terribly bigoted notions, at least sort of leaning, you know, in that direction or expressing sympathies in that direction. And, you know, that goes back to the Sierra Club and the example I mentioned about, you know, about John Muir as a sentiment. And, you know, and in my article, I look closely at a chapter in which the Sierra Club itself was an active participant in this conversation and ultimately defended, you know, a a non-racist position for environmentalists, but was really, you know, kind of on the fence about that for a long time, where, you know, legendary American environmentalists like David Brower were strongly on, you know, on the side of the Sierra Club standing for controlling immigration as a form of protecting the American environment. And I think you see that, you know, in lots of different ways, if you look closely at what environmental organizations do in the United States today. For example, you know, deeply devoted to the protection of land, the conservation of land, the purity of that land, a lot less involved in, you know, in issues of, you know, inequality or, you know, or climate justice or environmental justice issues when we talk about, you know, the largest environmental groups in the United States. So, you know, there is a systemic vulnerability there in that community that comes out in things like, you know, this story about John Tanton, because the whole community of John Tanton and his colleagues and the people who run the organizations that he founded, almost all of them, you know, have strong environmentalist leanings and arose out of, you know, these environmental organizations and their history.
And Tanton was able to connect with like-minded people to a certain extent through environmentalism. And then this anti-immigrant rhetoric became a larger and larger part of his philosophy. Without giving away too much of the story, and I want our listeners to go and read your piece, why don't you tell the tale of his evolution or de-evolution in the environmental movement as his life came to an end.
Yeah, you know, so my reading of John Tanton's brilliance, if you want to call it that, you know, he certainly was a, you know, a very intelligent individual, was that he, you know, with some sort of political, you know, acuity, he recognized that there was an overlap between these environmental issues, this interest in conservation, and his interest in eugenics and in preserving, you know, communities of European descent, for lack of a better way to, you know, call it. He was trending towards a white nationalism. And, you know, he recognized explicitly that he could build a stronger movement, not by just appealing to, you know, the most conservative elements that would already naturally agree with him, but by appealing to that, you know, that environmental community that had these sort of vulnerabilities, that had an interest in preserving, you know, an older notion of America, a wilder, a clean version of America. And he basically systematically preyed on, you know, on those sympathies throughout many, many decades. He wrote explicitly about the need to build a movement and to draw from the liberal side of the spectrum and to draw from the environmental movement. He indirectly, his, you know, his organizations waged this campaign with the Sierra Club to try to, you know, bring the Sierra Club and its 750,000 members, right? We're talking about just an enormous environmental organization in the United States, to, you know, to bear on the issue of, you know, of halting or slowing immigration into the United States, to turn the Sierra Club into an environmental, into an anti-immigrant organization. When that failed, you know, he again, you know, sort of preyed on those environmental sympathies and turned the direction of his immigration organizations towards the issue of climate change, and explicitly published studies that, you know, purported to link immigrants to rising carbon emissions and things like that, to basically make the argument that, you know, that immigration was causing climate change, that immigrants were causing climate change. You know, he did that as his organizations grew in influence and power, and they eventually became far more powerful than he was. I write in the piece how, you know, the Federation for American Immigration Reform and Center for Immigration Studies become, you know, the quintessential lobbying groups in Washington that affect the laws that we think about, or the lack of, you know, of laws and policy progress that we know about when it comes to immigration. That they, when you hear about, you know, Arizona's, you know, law to stop people on the streets and ask them for documentation, right? That arose from lobbying from the Federation for Immigration Reform. You know, the DREAM Act has been, you know, curtailed and delayed from passage because of efforts of these groups. They become incredibly powerful, and they guide the conversation we've had today. And ultimately, their sentiments, their rhetoric, you know, has gotten picked up repeatedly, hundreds and hundreds of times by right-wing influencers, by right-wing radio, by people like Tucker Carlson. And they repeat those messages or they morph those messages and they kind of evolve over time. It's like, you know, the old playground game of telephone, really. I mean, you start with an idea and you say something one way and somebody else says it in a slightly, you know, different way, maybe a slightly more inflammatory way or slightly more dangerous way. And it evolves through steps over time. And then it's heard by, you know, and absorbed by people like Patrick Crucius and other mass shooters around the world and in the United States who, you know, have referenced the same sentiments in, you know, in their manifestos and the things that they write, that call themselves eco-fascists, that refer to themselves as protectors of, you know, of the environment. And the danger is, and what the academics that I talk to warn me of, and the, you know, counterterrorism experts that I talk to warn me of, is that, you know, as the pressures of climate change get worse, and these sentiments and sympathies are already kind of floating around there in, you know, in the kind of ecosystem of, you know, of far right ideas, that, you know, it suggests a more volatile reaction in the future, maybe an organized reaction, you know, that you begin to see explicit campaigns to use the pressures of climate change to, you know, to divide us further, you know, to justify more hate, to justify policies that close the border, and so on.
The fire escape is folded like the cradle of an arm. Our dread so deep, we've learned to keep it near without alarm. But every fear is like a prayer. Learn to shout out loud from your lips to God's ear. It turns the face of every crowd. And now here comes everybody, a closet renegades, a weary, hungry soldier from the children's lost crusade. Here comes the restitution we'd all but given up. This evening we're content believing that love will be enough.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Abram Lustgarten from ProPublica. So Abram, you're talking about this anti-immigrant hate becoming normalized. I can't help but think of the Republican National Convention this summer, where I saw thousands of people chanting mass deportation or something to that effect. The messaging has become so normalized that quote unquote normal people feel comfortable being on national television chanting this kind of hate. It's become acceptable.
Yeah, I think that's right. And to the degree that that is true, a very, very significant part of the responsibility for that goes straight back to John Tanton. I mean, that is why he's such an important sort of node of activity on this issue. But I want to be clear, you know, I mean, this is a nuanced issue. I don't want to overstate, you know, that climate change is primary driver of immigration to the United States. It's not. It's a factor among many, many others, and it's probably a growing factor. And I also, you know, don't want to deny what to me seems pretty clear from having looked at immigration and border issues for a long time, which is that, you know, we have a system that's broken and needs to be repaired. So, you know, not a conversation about whether or not we should allow immigration. I kind of, you know, leave that to the side. It's a problem in need of some policy. But to the extent that the rhetoric is extraordinarily vitriolic, to the extent that it leads to violence and hate and begins to intertwine with other things like rising white supremacy and white nationalism in the United States that isn't just immigration focused, you know, there is a very strong thread there that ties to environmentalism and ties to John Tanton and ties to his early recognition that climate change was going to exacerbate all of this.
You end your piece quoting Crucius. Many people think that the fight for America is already lost. They couldn't be more wrong. This is just the beginning. So in your research of Crucius's manifesto and where he became familiar with these ideas, was he reading directly from a John Tanton, or was he a couple generations removed from it? Where did Patrick Crucius swerve so far off the road of basic sociology?
So we actually know less than you might think about Patrick Crusius's thinking. Most of that is still tied up in in court cases that are sealed at the moment. I did not base my reporting off of direct links between him and John Tanton. I don't have evidence that he read John Tanton or anything like that. But what is really clear is that the sentiments that he wrote in his manifesto very, very strongly echo things that John Tanton said and things that John Tanton's colleagues said and things that John Tanton's organizations published over many, many years. The ideas are clearly overlapping. And where Patrick Crusius got those ideas from, whether he got them from a friend down the street or got them from Tucker Carlson or got them from reading John Tanton himself, I don't know. And I don't know if we'll ever know. And that was kind of my interest in trying to trace the genesis of these ideas. But the ideas are very clearly the same. And at the same time, Patrick Crusius was at the time, a 21-year-old kid who didn't appear to have, not kid, he's an adult and he's responsible for his actions, but did not appear to have, a broad range of life experience and was not necessarily a deep thinker on these issues so much as, a reactive thinker to some of the influences around him that seemed to have destabilized an already, unstable situation. And so, I see Patrick Crusius not as, the sign of the future or a great actor, but really as, just one of the symptoms that's popping up of a much larger, theme. And if I can just step back for a second, and take the 40,000 foot view, of this and why I looked at this story, it's because I think that we are all paying too little attention to, the human impacts of climate change, to the pressures of climate change and what that does to society and to politics and to communities, not physically, not the disaster threats and things like that, but what it does to the way that we relate to each other. And the United Nations has a spectrum of scenarios that they use to define, the futures that they're predicting for climate change. And one of them calls for, rising nationalism, a turn inwards in our domestic focus, and growing conflict. And there's very little exploration of what that means and what that looks like. And that's basically the premise, for my reporting is, when we look at the United States politically, culturally, do we start to see the friction that's growing or being enhanced by the pressures of drought, by the wildfires, by forced retreat, by immigration, to the extent that it's, driven by climate change, and by each of these issues. And that's what led me to look at immigration for this particular story and led me to look at John Tanton. I think it's just one example of many ways that we're starting to see that the impacts of climate change are dividing us with enormous potential risk.
Abram Lustgarten, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Stevie Wonder, Alex Wise, and Joe Henry. To read a transcript of this show, go to seachangeradio.com. Stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast on our site or visit our archives to hear from Doris Kearns Goodwin, Gavin Newsom, Stuart Brand, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.